This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Not everyone likes my guest, comic Sarah Silverman. Her fearless social comedy turns off some people, but has also won her devoted fans. On the surface, her comedy may seem offensive to Jews, African Americans, Latinos, gay people, you name it. But that's because she's in persona as someone who is clueless, uninformed, but certain in her beliefs. Her Comedy Central series, The Sarah Silverman Program, had its season finale last week. It was the third and perhaps final season, but is available as downloads. Silverman is often the high point of award shows. She won an Emmy in 2008 for her video, whose title I can't say on the air, so I'll call it I'm Bleeping Matt Damon. It was first shown on The Jimmy Kimmel Show and went viral on the internet. Not being shy about herself, Sarah Silverman has titled her new memoir, The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. A little later, we'll talk about the bedwetting problems that plagued her when she was growing up. Let's start with a clip from the Sarah Silverman program. Sarah is in a restaurant at a table with her sister, Laura, who's played by Silverman's real sister, Laura, and Laura's husband, Officer Jay McPherson, played by Jay Johnston.
Did you tell Sarah the news?
Oh, it's nothing.
Nothing? What, are you flipped your lid or something? Come on, tell her.
Well, I'm creating a Holocaust memorial for Valley Village.
How adorable is that?
Why would you have a memorial for something that never happened?
That's not funny, Sarah. You know, a joke like that just demonstrates that you don't understand what it really means to be a Jew.
I think I know what it means to be Jewish, Laura. Check this out. Excuse me? These pancakes are ishy.
Laura is right. You really should be more interested in the Holocaust. I mean, I'm not even a Jew, and I love the Holocaust. Love reading about it, because it's so interesting and stuff. The things that happened.
You know, you should really think about becoming more invested in our history. You know, there's a great class that you can take.
Oh, Yom Kippur. You know, Laura, I am getting extremely bored at you, and I will not tolerate it. Never again.
Sarah Silverman, welcome back to Fresh Air. So I have to ask you, are you good for the Jews or bad for the Jews?
I'm good for the Jews.
How do you know? How do you know?
I think that whenever a Jew has any kind of notoriety, good or bad, the Jews find it to be good. You know, it's like, you know, Son of Sam? Jewish. You know, like, so I think Jews tend to... hold me in fairly high regard. I don't think that I, you know, and also because Jews tend to be able to take a joke. You know, it's kind of like there's a difference.
When it's coming from Jewish people.
Yeah. Or it's good hearted.
I want to play another example of your humor. And this was, people might remember in the 2008 presidential campaign that in support of Barack Obama, you did a video called The Great Schlep to get out the older Jewish vote in Florida. And the excerpt will play explains the premise of The Great Schlep. So here it is. This is Sarah Silverman.
If Barack Obama doesn't become the next president of the United States, I'm going to blame the Jews. I am. And I know you're saying like, oh my God, Sarah, I can't believe you're saying this. Jews are the most liberal, scrappy, civil rightsy people there are. Yes, that's true. But you're forgetting a whole large group of Jews that are not that way, and they go by several aliases. Nana, Papa, Zadie, Bubby, plain old Grandma and Grandpa. These are the people who vote in Florida, and the Florida vote can make or break an election. If you don't think that's true, why don't you think back to two elections ago when a little man named Al Gore got by Florida. I'm making this video to urge you, all of you, to schlep over to Florida and convince your grandparents to vote Obama.
So that's Sarah Silverman. And by the way, she has a new book called The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. So what kind of reaction did you actually get from the two audiences that this was aimed at? The grandchildren who were supposed to convince their grandparents to vote and the grandparents who were supposed to be convinced to vote for Obama.
You know what? It was universally positive. It really was. I don't remember.
Wow. Have you ever had anything that was universally positive
before? No. And you know what? I mean, I said stuff like, get off your fat Jewish asses. You know what I mean? Like, I made, but I guess you're right. Coming from a Jew, you know, it eases the blow. But I think that ultimately, people like to be seen, even if it's not in the most beautiful light, you know, I think. And I think it's a culture that that has a dark humor and has a humor about itself in general.
Okay, so you've titled your book The Bed Wetter, and some of your book is devoted to the fact that when you were young, you used to wet your bed just about every night, which was a horrible humiliation for you, particularly for, like, sleepover parties, camping trips. How long did this last?
You know, I was a bed wetter until I was about 15, and it was humiliating. You know, I was sent to sleepover camp since I was six, and, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. And it's, but, you know, I guess the silver lining is there's not much to lose after that in life, you know. I think, you know, doing stand-up when I got a little older, the prospect of bombing was like, who cares?
You know, like, as long as you're not peeing on stage accidentally.
Please. Yeah.
So what did you do to cover up when you were young and you were you were going to sleepover parties or summer camp?
A lot of it was just denial. I think I pretended it didn't happen more often than not. You know, at camp, I would just make my bed over it. I would take my clothes off and put it deep into the hamper, and I probably reeked of pee. And at sleepovers, I would kind of pinch myself awake and try to not drink anything too late and, like, just go to the bathroom as much as I could. And but, you know, when you pinch yourself awake all night, eventually your body gives in when you're a little girl, and you fall asleep even deeper than ever. So it was usually unfruitful, or fruitful in a bad way.
Did it make you feel out of control because it was something so fundamental that you couldn't control? Did it make you think that you were just out of control of your body in general?
Yeah, I think so. That's interesting. I mean, it was frustrating to have something that I couldn't control. It was, you know, I was a hairy kid, you know, with hairy arms and hairy legs because I wasn't allowed to, you know, shave my legs yet. And it was so different than everybody else. I grew up in a very blonde, L.L. Bean kind of New England town. And so the things that were frustrating were things I couldn't control. And that's probably the way it is for everybody to a degree.
So you tell a great story in the book about when you were, I think you were like in high school or something, you were watching The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And a comic comes on, a woman comic, who's talking about bedwetting. And you talk about the impact that had on you. Can you tell that story?
It actually wasn't a comedian, but an actress.
An actress, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Her name was Jane Badler. And she was an actress going on Johnny Carson to talk about a miniseries she was in called V, which coincidentally is now a series that they've revamped. And she was beautiful, and my mom got excited. She sat with me to watch it, and because she said this woman had been a Miss New Hampshire once. So it was exciting for us, you know, and there was like a connection. And here's this woman who had been Miss New Hampshire, and she's on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and we're watching her, and she very cavalierly talked about being a bedwetter as a child, and it was like the earth stood still. Like, I couldn't believe it, you know, and this thing that I was sure would be my deepest, darkest secret of my life was something that was an anecdote for her, that life went on for her, and she was even beautiful and, you know, an actress on television and on Johnny Carson. And it wasn't dirty that she said it, and it wasn't no one's head exploded. And it kind of blew my mind. My head exploded.
I have a question that's maybe much too personal, but so you can tell me it's too personal and then I'll drop it. So after you got over the bedwetting part of your life, you discovered not too long after that, you discovered sex and liked it and had lots of it with lots of people. And would it be going too far to suggest that the part of your body that caused you the most humiliation then became a part of your body that gave you a lot of pleasure, connected you to men, opened up like a different world?
I think I definitely at the time associated it with power. You know, and that is such a neat point that I would never have thought of. But the part of me that caused so much pain and was so, I was so unable to control, became the part of me that controlled, was able to kind of control others. I think I also just developed so late that by the time I became like a sexual being, I was already a comedian. So it was, even though I wasn't known at all, I was in a comedy community where I got around a little for a couple of years, but I don't regret it. I really loved it.
Okay.
I got it out of my system.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you write about how before you were born, your parents had a baby who died as an infant. The baby was staying over at your grandparents' house, mm-hmm. and got accidentally strangled in the crib. By the way,
yeah, it was a faulty crib, and it had broken, and the baby had slipped down into the corner and had suffocated in that space.
A really horrible thing. Did your parents talk to you about this as a child?
You know what? Maybe they did. The way I remember it is my oldest sister, Susan, who was older than Jeffrey, she knew the story, and we were all very young, and she kind of told my sister Laura and I, told it to us almost like a ghost story. You know, we were kids. And that chapter is actually called The First Time I Bombed, because it's about how my father taught me how to swear when I was little, and I saw how adults would be shocked but give me approval. You know, I got approval from it, and it was addicting. You know, I saw this way that I could get approval, and I killed all the time, you know, as a very young kid. And I call that chapter The First Time I Bombed because my sister told us the story of Jeffrey, and shortly after my grandmother, who picked us up for our Sunday breakfast at a local diner, and she said, "Everybody buckle up," and I thinking I was going to kill, I said, "Yeah, we don't want to wind up like Jeffrey." And just silence. And my sisters turned and looked at me like I was crazy. And my grandmother just burst into tears, which I had never seen before. And I thought, what did I do, you know?
That interested me so much, since so much of your humor is about saying things that seem horribly inappropriate and potentially offensive. But it's not personal in the way that this is. I mean, your grandparents felt so guilty because the baby died at their home. And so this was hurtful in a way that your humor now is not. What did you learn from that experience?
I think, you know, I've been called edgy. But, you know, in all honesty, I think that there is a safety in what I do because I'm always the idiot. And unless you're listening to the buzzwords and not really taking into account the context or the content of it, you see that I'm the idiot always, the ignoramus in the scenario. So no matter what I talk about or what tragic event or, you know, off-color, dark scenario is evoked in my material, I'm always the idiot in it, you know.
Because your persona is the idiot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, I guess, in the car, you were really behaving like an idiot as opposed to being in the persona of
five.
An idiot.
I was five had been taught repeatedly that that saying bad things was adorable and appreciated. So it was the first time I was kind of had the first adult thought of there are consequences to my words.
I want to next play a clip of you on the Jimmy Kimmel Show and precede this by saying I was sad, as probably a lot of fans of yours and fans of yours who are also friends of Jimmy Kimmel were sad when you split up. You know, you feel like, oh, two people I really like are together. Isn't that nice? And then like, oh, no, they're split up. Oh, how sad. You know? And so I can imagine it's probably very uncomfortable to have a relationship in the public spotlight like that. But you both did something so funny with it. You were on his show. You'd been on his show several times when you were a couple. And then after you split, you were on his show. And everybody, I'm sure, would be thinking, oh, this is going to be so uncomfortable. And boy, did you use that to effect. So let me play the excerpt of you on Jimmy Kimmel after you'd both split up. Here it is.
So, how are things?
Good, good.
What have you been up to? Everything good?
Yeah, everything's been great. Really, really great. And you're good?
Good, yeah.
Good, good.
Nothing, you know. It's doing the show. So how'd you get interested in acting?
I was like the class clown and, uh-huh. You know, and the kind of funny one in my family and
You know, I've been reading a lot about you. I read that you started in like community theater in your hometown.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I just think that's really great. Sarah Silverman, how did you and Jimmy Kimmel decide to do that together on his show?
Well, like you said, we wanted to take advantage of the stuff we couldn't necessarily control, which was that, you know, people were aware of our private, you know, private stuff. And, we took advantage of it, you know. I don't know. It's just what you would imagine, you know. But, we did use, we had a source, you know, to pull from for our awkwardness with each other, certainly.
So, can I ask you a personal question? Do you want to have children?
Probably. I love children. I'm embarrassingly baby crazy. I could be in the middle of any intense conversation, and if somebody walks by with a baby, I'm gone. You know, I want to do it when it's kind of all I want. And I think that I could have a baby or have children and still have a rich life filled with other things. But I really want to do it when it's kind of the most important thing to me. And also, you know, I'm not going to have a baby. You know, I happen to think that there are already tons of perfectly good babies out there already born. And I don't necessarily need to see a little me and, like, do it right this time. I'm already trying to do it right this time with me, you know. So I can see myself adopting. I'm not in a rush to do it. I'm 39, I know, but when I think about having kids my own, I think, you know what, the older I am, as long as I can lift them and be alive for the big parts, I probably will have more patience and be able to be a better parent at young grandparent age. I don't know. I'm going with it because I'm 39 and not ready. But I do love kids, and I'm very good. I've got a lot of really good moves. Like a 3-year-old girl, that age around 3 to 5 or 6, I've got a really great move. This is what I do. I go, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell anybody. And I know you're not supposed to tell kids to keep secrets, but that's part of the rebellion. And then they go, okay. And I say, I'm a princess. But I dress normal because I want people to treat me regular. And their brains explode. It's really fun.
What kind of reactions do you get?
Oh, my God. Their eyes go so wide. It's really, and I went really far with it with my friends Sam and Nikki's daughter. I did that whole thing where I say I'm a princess and don't tell anybody. And I said, when I come visit you in New York, I have some of my old princess stuff. It doesn't fit me anymore. Would you be interested in it? Yes. Yes, I would. So I came to New York, and there's like this huge Halloween store on 4th and Broadway that used to be a Tower Records. And I went there and I bought a bunch of three-year-old, you know, size three little girl princess stuff. And I took it out of the package and mussed it up and put it in a trash bag and brought it over. That's the little pleasures.
Sarah Silverman, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's always exciting to be on Fresh Air with Terry Gross because I am an avid listener and fan.
Sarah Silverman's new memoir is called The Bedwetter. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tobacco industry is struggling to deal with a new sweeping law regulating tobacco for the first time. Declining cigarette sales because of health concerns is nothing new for the industry. The cigarette company's problem of how to sell a product that smokers were starting to realize could kill them was dramatized in the opening episode of Mad Men, the AMC series about an ad agency in the early 60s. The head of creative for the agency, Don Draper, is designing a new ad campaign for Lucky Strike cigarettes in the wake of new reports about the health hazards of smoking and a Reader's Digest article titled Cancer by the Carton. Draper is making his pitch to the father and son who own Lucky Strike.
Gentlemen, the Federal Trade Commission and Reader's Digest have done you a favor. They've let you know that any ad that brings up the concept of cigarettes and health together, well, it's just going to make people think of cancer.
Yes, and we're grateful to them.
But what Lee Jr. said is right. If you can't make those health claims, neither can your competitors.
So, we got a lot of people not saying anything that sells cigarettes.
Not exactly. This is the greatest advertising opportunity since the invention of cereal. We have six identical companies making six identical products. We can say anything we want. How do you make your cigarettes?
We breed insect repellent tobacco seeds, plant them in the North Carolina sunshine, grow it, cut it, cure it, toast it.
Well, there you go.
But everybody else's tobacco is toasted.
No, everybody else's tobacco is poisonous. Lucky Strike is toasted.
John Hamm in a scene from Mad Men. So, back to the real world. Last summer, Congress passed the Tobacco Control Act that will, for the first time, allow the federal government to regulate the tobacco industry. It puts tobacco products under the authority of the Food and Drug Administration. New regulations and restrictions are on their way. Also, cities and states across the country have been enacting indoor smoking bans, so tobacco companies have come up with new smokeless products so people can get their nicotine fix indoors. One new nicotine product looks and tastes like little candies. Just this week, the Harvard School of Public Health released a report warning that these products pose the risk of serious nicotine poisoning for children who eat them thinking they're just candies. Our guest, Duff Wilson, covers business and the tobacco industry for the New York Times. He talked about new smokeless tobacco products and new tobacco regulations with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Duff Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in June, while all of us were focused on health care reform and other issues, there was actually this very important piece of tobacco legislation enacted by Congress. What does it do?
It regulates cigarette products and tobacco for the first time in history. They've always been totally exempt from regulation, basically, as a food or a drug because of a Supreme Court decision about 10 or 12 years ago. So finally, the government can require tobacco companies to disclose what's actually in those cigarettes, and it can regulate the contents of them.
Right, and so now the Food and Drug Administration, right, the FDA, will finally have this under their purview. And you say for the first time they'll actually have to tell us what's in cigarettes. We haven't known that up to now.
That's right. We haven't known that. They won't have to tell us. The cigarette companies will have to tell the FDA. And then they may try to protect some of that as trade secrets, but it gives the FDA something to try to regulate, you know, like not only the nicotine levels, but all the other additives that they have in cigarettes.
Did this bill have specific provisions regarding, say, marketing and advertising of their products?
Yeah, it did. It rolls out a few important provisions, really. One of the main ones is they can no longer say they're light, mild, or low-tar cigarettes as of June 22nd this year. It was amazing to me to learn that these light and mild so-called cigarettes are just as dangerous as the regular full-strength cigarettes because people tend to inhale them deeper and hold them longer and take more puffs per cigarette, all to satisfy that nicotine addiction.
Now is there a ban on advertising in color here? I mean, is there some specific provision regarding their advertising?
Yes, that their advertising is supposed to be black and white text only. No colors, no images, except inside tobacco stores where kids aren't allowed or in adult reader magazines. So they're really trying to remove the color advertising that can be seen, let's say, from the street outside the corner bodega or convenience store. There's a further provision that would not allow any of those signs within 1,000 feet of a school or playground.
There's a much more visible warning label requirement with this new law as well?
Yes, that's one of the major changes we're going to see is cigarette packs, instead of that little warning the Surgeon General says, are going to have to be half covered, half the pack covered with a graphic warning label, including images. So we're probably going to see images of lung cancer and lip cancer and those kind of awful pictures that you see in some advertising nowadays in Canada and other countries. That's supposed to go into effect in 2013, so it's a ways off. And this packaging image, if you will, like the disease pictures on the pack, are going to be fiercely opposed, really, in the courts, and we'll see which way the courts go.
Wow. I want to talk about some other provisions and some other trends in the industry, but I have to ask you first, where did the impetus for these tough new regulations come from? You know, I think a lot of us, you know, I'm sure, I know they were reported on, but a lot of us may not have been paying close attention. Where did the political momentum for these changes come from?
Politically, I think it kind of came from Henry Waxman in the House and Ted Kennedy in the Senate. It came from 1994 hearings in Congress when those tobacco executives for the seven largest companies testified under oath that tobacco or that cigarettes were not addictive, not harmful, and that they had not been targeting kids. And so Henry Waxman, the chairman of the House committee, he told me recently, after that, whistleblowers started coming out and industry documents were leaked out. He said after those executives, you know, lied before the whole American public in a congressional hearing. A couple years after that hearing, in 1996, the FDA tried to assert its own authority over cigarettes and say they were a drug delivery device and the nicotine was a drug. That was appealed, and the Supreme Court knocked that down by a 5-4 vote, saying that they needed special congressional authority. So it's taken from 96 until last year, 13 years, to get that congressional authority.
And how much of a factor was the election of Barack Obama, himself a smoker who has struggled to quit?
Yeah, you're right. That was a big factor, I think, having a Democratic House and Senate and Obama in the White House. President Bush was not a big supporter of this proposal. In fact, it only passed the Senate by a two-vote margin last year in one of those filibuster votes.
I wanted to talk about some of the new products that the tobacco industry has come up with. One of them are these products that are called snus. What are they?
Snus is a spit-free kind of tobacco-filled pouch, kind of like a tea bag, but smaller, that the user is supposed to put inside their upper lip. to get a nicotine hit without, you know, having to spit like they do on the baseball games and the cowboy movies.
And how long have they been around?
Snus is hardly even around now. It's only been test marketed in a few cities and is supposedly going to national distribution by one or two of the companies now. I don't think you can really find it very easily at stores, but they have hopes that it will grow.
Now, the other product that I've heard about are dissolvable tobacco products.
Yes.
Tell us about those.
The major one is from R.J. Reynolds. It's called Camel Orbs. And again, it also comes in a mint flavor as well as regular. And they look kind of like a Tic Tacs. They come in a box kind of that size, and they're these little pellets that are a dissolvable nicotine. Sorry, Dave, I haven't tried one. I don't really want to yet. But they're what anti-smoking groups for kids are really concerned about. The youth smoking opponents are really concerned that those Camel Orbs and similar dissolvable products are going to be attractive for kids because they look and sometimes taste a little bit like candy.
Now, I guess one of the big questions about these new smokeless tobacco products is whether they are safer. What do we know about that? Safer than cigarettes. I mean, you don't get it in your lungs,
yes.
I guess, right?
Yes, absolutely. The actual product itself is much less harmful than a cigarette, 90 to 99% less harmful, I think most people would agree. So the issue on it is whether it encourages more people to start down the path of cigarettes as it's kind of a gateway product, or actually helps more cigarette smokers who would otherwise be hurting themselves to hurt themselves less.
But I guess the serious health issue that some are raising is whether they're making this product, which, as you know, in some cases can look awfully appealing and somewhat like candy. Mm-hmm. They can make it, you know, that much easier for a young person to get started on.
Right. And if they can also make it easier for current smokers to continue smoking and get around the fresh air laws, so to speak. You know, there's three things that have been proven to help people quit. And smoking in this country has gone down over since the Surgeon General's report in 1964, from 42% of adults to less than half of that, under 20%. So we're making headways on less smoking, but we're still at 20% of adults. Three things are proven to help encourage people to quit. Number one, high prices. And so governments, both state and federal, are taxing cigarettes at a very high level, and the prices have gone up. It's very price sensitive. The second one is these fresh air or indoor air laws, now expanding, I guess, to some sidewalks in New York. But that really has encouraged more people to quit because it's kind of stigmatized smoking. And the third one is education and knowledge about the dangers of smoking. But these new products that we're talking about, the snus and the Orbs and the rest of it, are really directly a way around the indoor air laws. That's been a very important component of the quit smoking movement.
What did the statistics tell us about how often smokers try to quit and how likely they are to succeed?
Nicotine's really hard to quit. It's really hard to quit smoking, especially if you start young. The statistics say that a lot of people try, though, like 45% of smokers try every year, every 12 months. Almost half of smokers try to quit, but only 2.5% succeed per year. So it's very hard to quit, and anything that can be done to help people quit, whether it's, let's say, the carrot of a nicotine replacement product or the stick of a stigma in indoor smoking bans, has encouraged more people to quit.
Only 2.5% succeeding in quitting is a pretty striking number, which raises a question about the future of whether we're really going to get people off cigarettes. How does the public health community view these smokeless products?
They're sharply divided over smokeless products and the so-called reduced harm products. It's the most divided or divisive issue in the public health community, because a lot of scientists and doctors that have battled smoking for decades say, hey, these are much safer than cigarettes. Let's encourage these reduced harm products. And others say indoor air laws, for instance, are a good way to get people to quit smoking. And if you give them an alternative like a pouch or a oral tobacco product during the workday, then they'll keep smoking outside of it.
Now, there's a major case that could be reviewed by the Supreme Court dealing with the industry's marketing of so-called light cigarettes. Now, as we know, the new law says they can't claim that these so-called light cigarettes are healthier. But there's a longstanding action by, I guess, the Justice Department they sued the tobacco companies for their past marketing of this. So tell us what that case is about and what the stakes are.
The Justice Department sued 9 leading cigarette companies for racketeering, conspiracy, fraud, lying about the risks of cigarettes, lying about marketing to kids, the whole 9 yards. They sued all these companies in the Clinton administration, I think. And then a federal judge convicted the tobacco companies of racketeering for all that activity in 2006. She said some really harsh things about the tobacco companies' deceptive marketing, and that's been on appeal. It was recently upheld by a court of appeals, and now both the tobacco companies and the Department of Justice have appealed this case to the Supreme Court. The tobacco companies want the racketeering conviction overturned. They don't want to be called racketeers. The Department of Justice wants to have the power to force them to disgorge past profits, over $200 billion in past profits. They're asking for the authority to force the cigarette companies to disgorge it because they were profits from a allegedly racketeering enterprise.
Wow.
So there's high stakes. The Supreme Court hasn't announced yet if it'll take the case, although that announcement may come within the next month or two.
So this would be a criminal conviction of big tobacco?
It is a conviction under the racketeering law that's mostly used for organized crime figures. Yes, it's a criminal conviction. They can be called racketeers, which they don't like.
Right, and when this happens to mob bosses, they go to prison. No tobacco executives are going to be in the dock, are they?
No, there's no prison proposed here at all. It was mostly used as a way to get all this evidence into the public arena about the deceptive marketing and the light cigarettes, and then to convict them as corporations. They're not being convicted as individual executives.
Okay, so that is the current rulings have upheld the racketeering conviction and the huge fine, and it may or may not be decided ultimately by the Supreme Court.
Yes, the latest appeals court ruling upheld that racketeering conviction. It may or may not be heard by the Supreme Court. And while the companies are trying to reverse the racketeering conviction, the Department of Justice is trying to push it even harder than they did years ago and to force them to give back over $200 billion in past profits. If that happens somehow, it could bankrupt the companies. So business analysts think that's very unlikely that the court would allow all the tobacco companies to be bankrupted and have to give back all their past profits, just from a practical view. Because a lot of this goes back to a practical consideration of, do we want to try to ban cigarettes or to have a prohibition on cigarettes? And that didn't work very well with alcohol, and few people want to actually do it with cigarettes. Here, you've got tens of millions of addicted customers, and they're going to find some way to satisfy that addiction, whether it's with a black market or legally through convenience stores like they do now.
Well, I'm sure you'll be keeping track of it. Duff Wilson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Duff Wilson spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Wilson covers the tobacco industry for the New York Times. You'll find links to all of Wilson's stories about the tobacco industry on our website, freshair.npr.org. Here's an old cigarette song sung by Abby Lincoln.
Two cigarettes in the dark. He strikes a match till the spark clearly traces one face is my sweetheart. Two silhouettes in a room, almost obscured by the gloom. We were so close, yet so far apart. It happened.
Merle Haggard's new album is called I Am What I Am, a phrase that recalls the pugnaciousness of the cartoon character Popeye. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that this new album is neither combative or passively nostalgic. Instead, it's a collection of new songs, all of them written by Haggard, that proves how thoughtful the 73-year-old country star remains.
I'm no longer a fugitive, and I'm not on the lam, and I'm just a rambler. I am what I am. I do what I do.
The relaxed, utterly confident twists in the phrasing Merle Haggard uses throughout his new album, I Am What I Am, proves that he is what he is, a country music star who takes great pleasure in Western swing, train songs, and the blues. He's made an album that's in his comfort zone, but he's a senior citizen bringing fresh takes on romantic themes. Two new songs he's written frame the idea of love, both new and old.
Love's always lovely when first two lovers meet, hand in hand, arm in arm, walking down the street, always seen together in everything they do. Love is always pretty when it's new.
On that jaunty little shuffle called Love Pretty When It's New, Haggard gives us a wink of reality in the midst of a lovely reverie about the pleasure of a new love affair. There's nothing bad about it till your lover says we're through, he croons, letting the dance floor fall out from under you just as you're ready to keep waltzing to that pretty rhythm. At the other end of the spectrum, Haggard creates a vision of what love is like when a lover never says it's through, and the years go by.
We're falling in love again after all these years. We're smiling for real again after all these tears. Somehow life took its toll and caused us to frown, and the weight on our shoulders took us all the way down. But the children are grown now.
That's a beautiful song on many levels. What's most immediately striking is the gentle ache in Haggard's voice, the way he reaches for a higher note in a manner that echoes the narrator reaching back into the history of the relationship he's singing about. The lyric is shrewd as well. You're not quite sure whether the narrator is falling in love again with his wife because of difficulties they've survived, or are simply entering a new cycle of closeness. There's rock-solid craftsmanship behind this music. Haggard has written or co-written every song on the new album, and it's striking the way he can come at familiar themes from different angles. A prime example of this is a song in which the ornery coot compares himself not to an outlaw or to a stubborn cowboy, but to a bad actor, incapable of disguising his true feelings in the moment.
I've never been much at making believe. Don't have any tricks hidden up my sleeve. If life is a comedy, where's all the laughter? 'Cause here on the stage I'm a bad actor. I don't know.
On songs like Bad Actor and the title song I played at the start of this review, Merle Haggard surrounds his gruff voice and delicate phrasing with acoustic guitar, piano, and the gentlest of drums to create music that courses with vitality. This is not the work of an old man basking in his past glories. It's the music of an artist who refuses to let you dismiss him as an old man, an artist whose time isn't even close to being up.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Merle Haggard's new album, I Am What I Am. You can stream Haggard's new album in its entirety on nprmusic.org, where you can also hear individual tracks from the album. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. We're delighted to have Jonathan Menhivar back from paternity leave and to welcome Lauren Krenzel to our full-time staff. We're really happy to have you, Lauren. I'm Terry Gross.